Welcome to the podcast, The Caring Scientist, Mission Sustainable. This is the podcast where we discuss sustainability in science and we give you hands-on tips on how you can reduce the environmental impact of your lab work.
Welcome to this special episode of our podcast. I'm Adriana.
And I'm Nicoline.
And in this episode, we want to explore the environmental impact of IT use and computational biology. You might be thinking that this episode isn't really relevant to a wet lab scientist, but we can assure you that it is. You are using IT on a daily basis, not just when you send emails and surf the internet, but also when you are using databases to search for sequences or proteins, algorithms such as BLAST to align your sequences, software to plot your data, and so on. And all of these actions leave an environmental footprint behind. We have invited two guests in this episode to try to understand how our computational actions impact the environment. Welcome, Jason Greeley and Loic Langlois.
Thank you for the invitation. That's really nice.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us.
So Loic is a PhD student at the System Genomics Lab, based at the University of Cambridge, and Jason is a PhD student at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in Australia. They have recently published work on the carbon footprint of bioinformatics and have created an online tool called Green Algorithms that enables the user to estimate the carbon footprint of their computation. You can find the link in the show notes. But before we are going to talk about IT and carbon emissions, I'm curious to hear what motivated you to study this, Loic.
Yeah, so it started in January 2020 with like the Australian bushfires. And so there was a big debate about the contribution of Australia to climate change with producing energy mainly based on coal. Around the same time, a paper by Strubel et al. Got published about the carbon footprint of big language models in machine learning. And so that kind of, we started wondering what about bioinformatics and computational biology? Could we do something similar and look at the carbon footprint of our own work? And then we started looking around and very quickly we realized that there was actually no work at all around that. A little bit in machine learning, but not much. And in all the other fields of science, no one looked at it, which was a bit weird because everyone's relying on computers so much, like in physics, in engineering, astrophysics, biology, math, I mean, everywhere, really. And that's where we had the idea of making an online calculator, similar to what you can do to, you know, you can say, I'm traveling from Paris to London, what's the carbon emissions corresponding to that? That's where it started. We're like, we'll just do a calculator that's as easy as possible.
Very nice. So, I mean, I really love the idea that you're making it easier for a lot of people out there. I think that's really important in the whole green transition in general. So you're mentioning algorithms and computations and IT use and stuff here. Maybe, Jason, can you explain to us what's the difference between regular IT use and algorithms and all of these things?
Yeah, so regular IT use, you know, what people do every day on their laptops or if they're going to work on their desktops is things like emailing, web surfing, you know, downloading and reading papers. So that's kind of what you would think of when you think of computers. But high performance computing or computing clusters, computing servers, all these things, they're essentially, it's just a fancy word to describe bunched up and connected computers that function as kind of a supercomputer, people call it. They're kind of different because you'll use these high performance computers to run large scale computations, which can require a lot more energy than, say, reading emails.
So when I send emails or do Zoom calls, I'm not using supercomputers, but if I would use an algorithm or something, then I would be using supercomputers located somewhere else. Is that like the simple way of saying that?
Yeah, so often if you have, say, big data, people generally call it. So if your data sets start getting a little bit too large for your laptop or your desktop, you'll end up doing the same jobs that you would want to do on your computer, but you submit it to more powerful and bigger, well-connected computers called clusters or servers or supercomputing. And that's where you can run kind of bigger data sets or bigger problems without having to stretch your laptop.
All right. And so now you're mentioning a few words that for some of us are very new words in our vocabulary, like cluster and server and data center or data farm. Can one of you explain in simple terms what are these things and how do they physically look like?
Sure. You know, when you have a desktop computer, you've got the screen and you've got the keyboard and you've got the tower under the desk that you switch on in the morning, and that's it. And if you have a complicated program to run, that works exactly the same way as just typing Word on text. You know, you ask your computer to do something, but sometimes it will take hours to do it. And, you know, you'll start in the morning and it will take quite a long time to do it, and then you'll be done. But now if it takes days, that would mean keeping your computer switched on and making sure no one comes around and like knocked it off and it stops working and everything. So a very simple way to solve that problem is to keep your screen and to keep your keyboard, but instead you take the tower and you put it in a warehouse with a lot of other towers, and everyone put their towers there basically. And it works exactly the same way, except, you know, it's going through the internet instead of having like a super long cable connecting your monitor to the tower. But other than that, it's, you know, it's exactly the same computer, except it's put in a warehouse. And same thing when you ask something very complicated from your laptop or your desktop, you'll hear the fans going on really loudly, and that's becoming a bit of a pain and generates a lot of heat just because like doing the calculation generates heat. So the benefit, another benefit of putting your tower in a data center is you can centralize cooling, and you can make sure that, you know, the cooling is very optimized because all the towers are well aligned. And that's basically what, when we call supercomputer, when we call that data centers or a data farm, that's exactly that. That's just everyone put their towers in a warehouse. That's also a way when you have large data sets, so you have a lot of data and, you know, your computer only has a certain memory, but if you need like 10 times that memory, instead of having to buy a new hard drive and, you know, it's a lot of money and a lot of time just for this one project that will last a week, instead, what you say is you say, oh, I will borrow that storage for 1 week, and then I will give it back and someone else will be using it. So it's just a much more efficient way to use resources.
Very, very nice explanation. I guess in practically people don't actually put their towers in these data farms, but they sort of, I guess they lease the use of those computers, right? So centrally, someone is making sure there are all the computers that are needed there and that it's cooled, and then you just pay a monthly fee to be able to tap into that system, right?
Yes, exactly.
And what about the word cluster now? Is that the same as supercomputers or data farm?
Yeah, we say cluster because, you know, it's a group of computers, so you have a lot of them. And that's from the fact that sometimes you have very complicated tasks and you say, okay, actually, I can't do the task on just one computer. I need five of them to be working for me for a week.
And what about cloud then? Is that also just exactly the same? It's a synonym for interconnected computers, not standing in your own living room or office.
Yeah. Google, Amazon, Microsoft, they have their cloud solutions and they have big warehouses where they have these computers. The only difference is when you have, if you work at a university, you usually have what we call our own cluster, our own data center, and it's usually down the road or, you know, in the IT department, in the basement, they have these huge racks of computers. The cloud is just the idea that you don't really know where it is and it's probably in another country or, you know, the other side of the country or something like that.
Okay, so now we sort of have all the vocabulary things in place. Now, why does it consume so much energy to do high-power computations, for example?
But for the same reason that your desktop or, you know, your laptop, for example, when the fan starts going, you will see your battery coming down very quickly. And you won't be able to like stay on battery for a very long time just because it uses a lot of energy to do all the calculation. Even in a data center, even if it's centralized and slightly optimized, it uses a lot of energy. In the data center, because, you know, you share resources, so you'll say, oh, I will use this computer for 5 hours, but now someone else can have it after that. If it's well done, someone else will have it just the, you know, the minute you leave it. So these computers, they're running almost nonstop. So you need to power that and you need to power the cooling. So yeah, that's just electricity consumption. And to produce this electricity, some carbon is emitted. That depends naturally a lot on whereabouts you are in the world, because each country produces energy in a different way.
We're actually going to put a link in the show notes so all the listeners can also check out what's on my energy grid and what are the emissions caused by my kilowatt hours in my region.
And regarding the cooling, right, how much percentage does go into cooling versus running the algorithm?
It looks like in a data center where it's, everything is as optimized as it can be, you will have about half of the power delivered, of the energy bill, basically, of the data center will be due to running things on the computers. 10% will be storing data, so long-term data storage. You know, when you do all your backup on Google Drive, for example, all this data is stored somewhere. And the 40% remaining is just overhead, so lighting the facility and mainly cooling, so making sure everything stays as cool as possible. Otherwise, computers just generate a huge amount of heat. So now there are big differences between data centers, because obviously this 40% overhead is really what you can try to reduce. So there are lots of work on that to make cooling as efficient as possible. So all the cloud providers, Google, Amazon, because the more efficient the data centers is, the more money they make. So they work really hard on making it as efficient as possible. It's why cloud computing is quite efficient in terms of energy. Well, like, you know, if you just have a small data center in a small institution somewhere, it's probably not very, very efficient, because they don't have the resources to make it efficient.
You mentioned the data storage now. How, I mean, many of us who work in a wet lab, we may not do a lot of computational stuff or using many algorithms, but some of us have really produced really large data sets. How does data storage connect with the CO2 emissions, and how bad is it to store your data?
Yeah, storage is, in terms of energy consumption, is a lot less energy hungry than running algorithms and, you know, running things on the computer, because it's passive. You know, you just put things on your hard drive and it will just stay there. But the difference with a computation that will last 5 hours, it's, you know, it's on for 5 hours and then it's off. Well, like data storage, you put it on the hard drive, but it has to be stored for a year, 10 years, and you want to be able to access it anytime. And because of that, we looked at it and it seems to be about 1 watt per terabyte of data, which is not a lot, but because it is for years or 10 years, and this data is also often duplicated, because you want backups. And that's really important, obviously, because if you just have one version of your data on one hard drive, even if it's in a data center and it's like really well maintained, hard drive just dies sometimes. And if that happens, then suddenly you don't have your data. So what they do is they put your data on different hard drives. So, you know, the likelihood of all of them dying at the same time is quite unlikely. And then they will even like copy your data on physical tapes. And they will take these tapes, put them in a truck, and move them halfway across the country. So if the warehouse burns down, your data is still safe.
This is super interesting insights into something that most of us know very little about. You know, you just drag whatever icon and put it somewhere, and this is what actually happens with it. That's really interesting. So earlier you mentioned this website that you created, this tool to calculate how much CO2 emissions are coming out of computational biology. Maybe, Jason, can you put a little more words on what this tool does and how it works?
Yeah, so what we tried to do is make a tool that's as easy to use and interpretable as possible. It's at green-algorithms.org if anyone wants to check it out. And essentially what you have to put in is some simple parameters of your computation, such as running time, what hardware, how much memory you use, you know, where you're based geographically. And essentially it will calculate or estimate your carbon footprint and contextualize grams of CO2 or kilograms of CO2 with interpretable metrics, such as how many months it would take an adult tree to actually absorb or sequester that amount of carbon, or how much of a percentage of a certain flight, say from Paris to London, would emit the same amount of carbon, or how far you could drive in a car to have the same amount of carbon. It also tells you, you know, how much actual energy, because as we said, the amount of carbon emitted per unit energy created varies across the world. Yeah, and essentially it generally provides a very quick way to estimate the carbon footprint of any computational algorithm.
That's super nice.
So we'll make sure that we put the link to your work in the show note. But now we are curious to learn more about what computational algorithms consume the most amount of energy. What were your findings?
One of the main things once we made the calculator was to start looking at actual bioinformatic analysis that are done. So I'll just give one example here. So a very classic example is molecular dynamic simulations. So we find some benchmarks that we estimated the carbon footprint of, and one of them was 100 nanoseconds of a molecular dynamic simulation of satellite tobacco mosaic virus. And essentially, using two different tools, you would estimate the carbon footprint of this analysis to be between 18 and 95 kilograms of CO2. which, if we contextualize that a little bit, is 19 to kind of 104 tree months. So 19 to 104 months that it would take an adult tree to sequester that, or to have the same carbon footprint, you could drive between 100 to 500 kilometers in a European car. So it's quite striking how big carbon footprint of some of these computational analyses can be.
And then it's even on a time scale like 100 nanoseconds. That's just mind blowing. I mean, it's 100 nanoseconds, but it could take a tree 100 months to sequester it.
Yeah. All that for 100 nanoseconds.
I don't do that, so I don't really know what they're doing. But basically what they do, they put molecules together in the software, and for 100 nanoseconds, they will move them around. But the software runs for between like 3 days and a week, basically. So it's multiple days.
So it seems there are definitely things that individuals can do to reduce how much carbon comes out of their computational work. But it also was very clear to me that there are choices for institutions to make. So what can an institution do on this matter?
Well, first, carefully select what data center you use. So institution, they have the in-house cluster or the in-house IT facilities, and they use a data center, but they can make sure that this data center is as efficient as possible. So when we talked about cooling, and you know, it can be anywhere between 10 and 40% of the energy bill is dedicated to cooling. Institutions can also decide, well, basically what type of energy. You know, when you get an energy contract in many countries, you can say, oh, I want only green energies, and it's usually a bit more expensive and you pay a bit more, but at least you know that all the electricity provided to your house is from green energies and doesn't have much carbon emissions.
Yeah. So anything else on an institutional level?
Transparency mainly. I guess the main thing is for institutions to actually include carbon footprint in their cost-benefit analysis. If they could also include in that the carbon footprint and say that's what it costs the environment in carbon, and just being transparent, saying this is the data center we use, this is where it's connected, this is what electricity gets into it, is it fully green energy, is it not, this is how efficient it is. So researchers who decide to use their institution's data center instead of using cloud computing, when sometimes they could do both, can make a decision based on facts and say, okay, well, actually, it would be a bit more sustainable to do this part of the work in the cloud, so let's rather do that.
I'm surprised to hear that that's hidden for many places, that you don't just easily get this kind of information.
No, it's just even large companies are quite protective of it. So they will advertise it. Google, for example, is really proud to have very efficient data centers. So they will have a page dedicated to that saying how efficient they are. But it's not to be transparent. It's just because it's becoming a marketing argument to say, let's do your computation in our data centers because we are efficient. So it's not just an institution problem. In general, everyone needs to be, all the companies having data centers need to be a lot more transparent about that.
And the rest of us have to ask for transparency to make that happen.
Yeah. If researchers start asking it, institutions will start making it available.
Another thing that institutions can do is to promote or implement the concept of FAIR data. So FAIR is the acronym for findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. This makes sure that we get the most out of the data that we produce. And that's not only great for science, but also for the environment. So we'll make sure to put the link in the show notes so you can read more about it.
All right. So those were some of the things that on an institution level can make a positive green difference. Now, I'm curious to hear if you have like concrete tips to what computational scientists can do.
So one of the first things you can do is, if you run kind of very elaborate or big data analysis and you're kind of testing pipelines or bringing in new data and trying out new methods and seeing, you know, trying to fit it all together, you can first run it on the smallest data set you can kind of get. So it'll run quickly. It will minimize essentially unnecessary computation before you scale it up onto the biggest data set or the biggest, you know, fancy algorithm you want to run. You should essentially do all your testing and training and little tweaks to your setup on a small amount of data as possible. One other thing that people can start doing is sharing their results and keeping their data open, you know, obviously if it's possible for some things, it's not possible. Because what that does is, so there's an example in computational biology in a thing called a GWAS, genome-wide association study. And essentially, it's just a large-scale statistical association between genetic variants and a given outcome. So what happens when people do this is they share their effect sizes and p-values all around in their paper so that when other people go to do the same type of analysis or work with the same types of things, they just look up these results that people have put online rather than having to run their own GWAS. So there's just a couple of things you can do to try to keep your results as open as possible and to share them around to minimize people doing the same thing you've done for the same results. It's just unnecessary. Another thing you can do is keep your hardware as long as possible. Don't upgrade your laptop and your computational servers every year, because there's actually a very large environmental impact from generating the computational hardware itself.
Yeah, so the total carbon footprint of a device, it will be, yeah, you got producing it, using it, and disposing of it. It's the main three things. But actually, out of that, yeah, 70 to 80% of the total carbon footprint is just producing it. So using it is very small compared to the rest, and disposing of it is also quite small. So it's all about the production part of the devices. So if you don't buy a new one, you don't produce a new one.
And this goes both for...
It goes mainly for consumer devices. So that number is mainly for smartphones, tablets, and laptops.
So anything else?
So yeah, one of the simplest ways any kind of computational researcher can reduce their carbon footprint is by keeping and using the most up-to-date software. So in one of the papers that we've kind of pre-printed recently, we estimated the carbon footprint of a GWAS, one of these very common genome-wide association studies, using a version 1 of a tool, Bald LMM, and version 2.3. The carbon footprint when you used version 2.3, the most up-to-date version, was actually 73% less than if you used version 1. So you can imagine if you're doing large-scale GWASs, which very many people around the world are doing, you could simply update your tool and reduce your carbon footprint by 73%. So it's one of the quickest and easiest ways you can actually reduce your computational carbon footprint.
And I guess when you pick a tool that is greener, you will also spend less hours on running it, right?
I mean, you save money and carbon. Sometimes you will have to sacrifice a bit of, you know, you'd say, okay, it will run a bit longer, but it will be so much more carbon efficient. And that will happen sometimes. But in the vast majority of the cases, it will be so much faster that it will save money to the lab, or because you're not using as much compute hours and saving energy, and you'll run a lot faster and be good for the environment. So it's usually a win-win strategy. It's just putting the effort in to look into that.
Looking into whether there could be alternative software that is more efficient.
Yeah.
Finally, now we spoke about what the computational biologist can do. There are also things that the wet lab scientist can do.
And here are the top actions that you can take as a wet lab scientist. Number one, discuss your experimental setup with your computational colleagues before doing experiments that need more complex computational analysis. This reduces the amount of computational work that your colleague has to do, and thus you save both time and energy. Number two, make sure your data is in a standardized format and easily accessible, so others can use your data down the line instead of having to reproduce it. This is especially important to keep in mind when you are leaving a lab. Number three, be a minimalist. Only keep data that is important and delete unnecessary data or duplicated files. Make sure the files are labeled correctly and sufficiently. Talk to your group leader about which data sets should be kept when you leave the lab. Number four, lastly, instead of sending the same attachment to several people at once via email, put the files on a drive and send a link. This way, the files would not be stored by all the individual email inboxes, but just in one place. This means less data storage, less energy consumption, and less CO2 emissions.
So with that, we have actually arrived at the end of today's episode. This was the very first special edition where we had guests, and it's been a lot of fun and we learned a lot. So we really want to say big time thanks to Loic and Jason for sharing all your knowledge on this topic.
No, thank you. That was really fun and yeah, really interesting. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was really awesome.
So before we finish this special episode, we would like to acknowledge Estel Goyado-Kams, who is a PhD student at Radboud University Medical Center in the Netherlands. Estel is a green scientist by heart, not only at Radboud, where she writes blog posts on green matters, but also in a national context, as she is the co-founder of the Green Labs Netherlands initiatives. Estel wrote a blog post about carbon emissions from computational work and reached out to us about this important topic. She also got us in touch with Loic and Jason and helped with scripting this episode. Without her, really, this episode would have not been possible. So thank you very much, Estel.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of our podcast. Today, the topic was a little different because it was mostly about IT and not so much about wet lab work, but we hope you realize that wet lab scientists also can make a difference in terms of IT use related carbon emissions. As always, feel free to drop us a line if you have any questions or comments or ideas for future episodes. We would be super happy to hear from you.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, please feel free to email us at podcast@avasustain.com. That is podcast@avasustain.com. We have also put this email address and other useful links in the notes below this podcast. Till next time.